Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Wow. Wow, what a week. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm going to talk to you, I hope, next week, depending upon what transpires between now and then that needs to be covered, that the rest of the media is not covering. Oh, what a big surprise. But this morning, we are going to talk about a number of things, and it's going to be rapid fire. I'm going to get into depth in some of them, and I'm going to just give you the skim of things that you're not hearing elsewhere on others. We're going to talk a little bit about inflation, the economy, some very dangerous undercurrents in the housing market, housing and housing mortgage finance, which nobody, I mean zero, nada, no one is talking about, that everybody who owns a home needs to know. And I've been ringing bells on this for a year, folks. So I'm going to ring some more bells tonight. I think you'll find it fascinating. Kind of a repeat that's being swept under the carpet of what happened in 2008, 2009. We're going to talk about, very briefly, what's happening in the European economy. That's going to tie in, by the way, with our historical story of this morning, because what would a Right Side Radio show be without our historical story? And you'll find that fascinating. In fact, your eyes will bug out of your head at this story. Now, I flat guarantee you, it'll make you think. We're going to talk just a little bit about what's happening internationally, because I can hit it in staccato, rapid-fire fashion. And they're big events. They're big, important events. And depending upon which way they topple, which way they drift, which way they fall, they could be changing, world-changing events. And they're barely being covered. I mean, they're not being covered at all by the mainstream media. They're obsessed with impeachment mania. And yes, we're going to talk a little bit about the impeachment mania, but I'm going to bring to light some things that you may not know, or at least haven't had all put together for you. And I'm going to make it very brief, because as I have told you for the last several months, this is nonsense. It is going to stand to benefit Trump. It is a desperate attempt to wound Trump with more of the thousand paper cut theory. You know, if you can't bring him down with a shell, then you cut him 1,000 times, and hopefully he bleeds enough to not be able to move forward. But it's really about Joe Biden and the left wing of the Democratic Party wanting him out of the race to open the way for Warren or perhaps Michelle Obama, which I have warned about for several years, who just came out with, gee, what a coincidence, her second book. What does every single, there is no exception, presidential candidate do before they run? Oh yeah, they write a book. I mean, Edwards and Kennedy and Barack Obama and Donald Trump and ad infinitum. So she just came out with her second, or is about to come out with her second, and I don't think there are any coincidences when it comes to politics in America and the seedy underbelly of Washington D.C. also known as the swamp or the deep state. And by the way, to remind you, if you go back 3 or 4 years, if you type in the words deep state, if you type in the word shadow government, in the search bar on the ontherightsideradio.com website, you will see that I was, if not the first, amongst the three first in media to bring to your attention the word deep state and the word shadow government. Very interesting. And boy, has it manifested itself since just before the 2016 election, has it not? Well, we're also going to talk, which actually I'm surprised the press is not really talking about. I mean, they've kind of gloated over it briefly today and the last few days. But there have been three quite adverse material court rulings against the Trump administration in just the last several days. Oh, big surprise, all by Obama-appointed judges. And fortunately, all of them, are, except for one, which is in the D.C. Court of Appeals, and it was not the en banc kind of full tribunal of the court. It was just three of the court's members. The other two were at the district court, United States District Court level, which means they're appealable to appeals courts, etc., and then finally the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court could also hear the D.C. case. And they might very well, because it goes to executive power, separation of powers between the branches, and the right of one branch to investigate another, particularly for political purposes, I might add, which all this is. This has nothing to do with the Constitution. This has nothing to do with saving the Republic. You know, I mean, what the Democrats are doing is just straight, pure, hardball, down and dirty, despicable politics at the expense of America and the American people. But they don't care about that. They've never cared about that. Now they're just kind of showing their colors. And, of course, they have their legions, the 30% of America that, I don't know whether they can't think or won't think, but they're the rah-rah crowd behind them. And, of course, it's all fueled by totally fake news polls. There was a poll, I'm sure you heard about it, because all the mainstream media was, like, all over this poll. 51% of Americans want President Trump impeached. Well, you know, if you read the questions in the poll, they're entirely leading. Like, you know, if President Trump committed a heinous crime like murder, rape, I mean, not, I'm exaggerating. Would you want him impeached? Well, yeah. I mean, any president who commits a high crime against the United States, like Barack Obama did on many occasions, should be impeached. In Barack Obama's case, I think stiffer measures are warranted. But that's another tale for another night. Although he will be mentioned in one of the segments tonight, because it amplifies and underlines what I've told you for years, which is the Cloward and Piven theory. The way you bring down capitalism and democracy is you overburden it with debt. And Barack Obama did that, and he did it purposefully. He did it intentionally. This will all tie in to the segments tonight. Anyway, we're going to go over those court cases very briefly, just so you're up to speed, and you can kind of follow the bouncing ball, and we'll see which way they land. Let's start off with our historical story, which I think you will find absolutely fascinating. And I think it will make you think, because there are parallels between Germany in the years roughly 1917 through 1926, 1927 to America today. There are also differences, but there are many parallels, particularly in military and spending and all that kind of stuff. So let's begin with our story and kind of a horrifying story. So it is October 11th. Gee, imagine that. 1922. The German Central Bank and the German Treasury take a step in a process that they had begun years before, after World War I, to try and jumpstart what at that time was a stagnant German economy. And what they figured out was the way to stimulate this economy, or the way what they thought they figured out, was easy money. Easy money. And what they did, they thought that they would bring all their monetary and their currency base in line with market realities. And they kept printing money. You know, well, under the theory that the more money that was available, the cheaper the interest rates, the easier it was, the more stimulation, the more people would take loans, the more people would spend. Does this sound familiar? You know, like the Federal Reserve printing money to buy our own bonds, one hand buying the debt of the other and calling it real money. Let me continue. I digress. So, they devalued the mark on October 11th, 1922. And the new value was going to be 2 billion marks to a dollar. At the beginning of World War I, folks, the exchange rate had been 4.2. That's just 4.2 marks to the dollar. The new value, let me repeat that, would be 2 billion marks to the dollar. So, 13 months later, this is late November 1923, you would need 4.2 trillion, think about this, 4.2 trillion marks to equal $1. Basically, in 10 years, the amount of money in the form of German marks needed to equal $1. This would be from 1913 to 1923, increased 1 trillion fold. Think about that. 1 trillion fold over that 10-year period. To put this in perspective, because this began what was called the Weimar Republic, and this began a massive inflation, which in fact led to the rise of Adolf Hitler and precipitated and formed the foundation of World War II. Because in the end, all wars are economic. And we've talked about that many times on this show. Economics creates the need for war, whether it's for resources or for money, or for power to obtain resources and money, or because of an unsettled or unhappy nation or an unsettled populace that demands, quote-unquote, action, do something. So, to put this kind of in perspective for you, I equated this to a loaf of bread for this segment, for this story for you. I'm gonna substitute dollars and cents instead of German marks because, to be honest with you, to me and to most of you, German marks don't really have any real tangible, fungible meaning in our heads. We think in dollars and cents. So I'm going to put German marks into dollars and cents, and I'm going to equate them to a loaf of bread. In the middle of 1914, just before the outbreak of World War I, a 1-pound loaf of bread in Germany cost 13 cents. 2 years later, 1916, it was 19 cents. In 1920, 4 years later, it sold for 22 cents. By 1919, it was 26 cents. In 1920, a loaf of bread would have been $1.20. In 1921, $1.35. By the middle of 1922, roughly 6 months after the $1.35 figure, it was $3.50. At the start of 1923, it was $700 for a loaf of bread. 5 months later, a loaf required $1,200 to be purchased. By September, 3 months after that, it was $2 million, German equivalent, to buy a loaf of bread. And 1 month later, it was I'm not making these numbers up. You could do the math yourself, and you can do the Google. Or don't do Google, because we don't support Google. Do a Bing. Do something else. Do a Yahoo. That loaf of bread, 1 month later, would have gone for $670 million. I want you to think about that for a moment. A one-pound loaf of bread for $670 million in German marks equivalent. Basically, in a period of 2 years, you know, the inflation began, and it began to accelerate, and then it began to accelerate within the acceleration, and then it began to accelerate exponentially. 1 month after the month it would have cost you $670 million to have a loaf of bread to slice and put butter and jelly on, it hit $3 billion. I'm not making these numbers up. You're all shaking your heads. $3 billion equivalent in German marks to buy a loaf of bread. Just think about that. And then, by mid-month, 2 weeks later, it was $100 billion to buy a loaf of bread in the Weimar Republic of Germany. And then, of course, by now, riots had broken out. There was total civil unrest. There was all sorts of things going on. And then, of course, it collapsed. And from the ashes rose your friend and mine, Adolf Hitler. I say that in jest, obviously. To put this in perspective, this has to do with the creation of money. Okay? And I realize I'm digressing a little bit from my story, but it's important for you to understand for the context of this story, because the numbers, the inflation, $100 billion for a loaf of bread. This is true. I'm not making this up. How do I say this easily? Okay. The more dollars you have, or the more German marks you have, in the case of our historical story, the less each one is worth, right? It's like any other good, services, or commodity. The more you have, the less each one is worth. The less you have, the more each one is worth. What are the Western economies of the world doing? And some of the third world economies like Zimbabwe and South Africa and Argentina, all of whom have, you know, rampant inflation. How about Venezuela? I mean, the answer, Maduro's answer down there to the economic woes is to print more money. It's kind of like the Weimar Republic. In fact, it is the Weimar Republic. And in the end, all economies that print money indiscriminately become like the Weimar Republic. Perhaps a loaf of bread won't cost $600 billion dollars. Maybe it'll only cost $100 billion. Oh, well, how not? We just saved $500 billion on a loaf of bread. We're doing great. The total currency supply, the total money supply of Germany in 1913, before this all began, was 6 billion marks. In November of 1923, that loaf of bread we were talking about would have been 428 billion marks. In other words, and a kilo of fresh butter would have cost, hold on to your seat now, 6,000 billion marks. That's right, 6,000 billion marks. You'll note that a kilo of butter in November of 1923 in Germany cost 1,000 times more than the entire money supply of the nation just 10 years earlier. Now, that would give you an idea of hyperinflation. So in 1913, Germany had a solid, prosperous, advanced culture, population. It was a monarchy under the Kaiser. And then, of course, the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914, the world moved toward war. Each side thought the other would never go to war. And so in a global game of chicken, they, in fact, stumbled into what is known as the Great War, World War I. The Germans were convinced they were going to win this war. They were going to win it quick. It was going to be short. It could be sweet. And they could finance all the costs of this quick, sweet, sweeping victory with war reparations that they, as victors, would extract from the losers. Except that the war was long. Most of their young men were killed or wounded. Their workforce, in other words. The deficit, of course, to finance the war soared. It was supported by foreign and domestic bond buyers. Does this sound familiar at all? The foreign and domestic, I'll quote something here. And this is from a number of scholars who have studied the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the hyperinflation. Quote, the foreign and domestic public willingly purchased new debt issues when it believed that the government could run future surpluses to offset contemporaneous deficits. Basically, that was saying, hey, this is a great nation, and it's probably just a speed bump in the economy. Huh. Gee, can you imagine anybody ever doing that again? Oh, that's right. That's right. People buying European bonds, people buying United States bonds. It's a great nation. It's just a speed bump in the economy. The enormity of the numbers in this tale of hyperinflation is they're difficult to grasp. I mean, some of you are probably still struggling with the fact that a kilo of butter costs 6,000 billion equivalent dollars. But that's what it cost. And that's because there were 6,000 billion equivalent U.S. dollars in marks available because they were printing it. In other words, the more they printed, the more the inflation took off. Now, let me step back for a moment from our historical story. I'm going to get back to it in a moment. What did Barack Obama do? Barack Obama increased the debt of the United States from approximately $5.2 trillion, reprehensible, by the way, George Bush, $5.2 trillion to approximately $16, give or take, trillion in his 8 years in office. That is a dramatic increase in debt and money supply. And then, of course, we have the current deficits, which are fueled by, oh, yes, the printing of money and the selling of bonds. some of them, many of them, being sold to our own Federal Reserve, who is holding down the trigger of the Treasury's printing press. Let me continue with our story. Obviously, people demanded, pensions became meaningless. And I've talked about pension problems bubbling around in the United States and, by the way, overseas. If you had in Weimar Germany a 400 mark monthly pension, you were comfortable. And then when this all began, you were penniless in a matter of months. It got to the point where people demanded to be paid daily so they wouldn't have their wages devalued by the passage of a day or two. That's how rapidly this hyperinflation exploded when it became exponential. People heated their homes, folks, by burning money instead of coal. I want you to think about that. The money was so worthless in the Weimar Republic that people had such, shopping bags full, boxes full, that they actually used it to heat their homes. It was more valuable than as an agent for purchasing goods and services. Pretty amazing. With its culture, social chaos, culture collapsing, its economy disintegrating, social chaos, obviously, there was this guy named Hitler. And he began his 10-year effort to come to power. And he traded on the chaos and the street rioting. If you remember, Hitler was a lefty, folks. A big lefty. Not a Lenin lefty, but a Hitler lefty. The Democratic National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party. In modern America, there are a number of Democratic politicians, and the dark money behind them, the Soros dark money and others like him, who not only trade on, not only finance, not only whip into a lather, chaos and anarchy. How many of you saw that despicable display of chaos, anarchy, hate, and near riot at the Trump rally in Minneapolis? Outside by the so-called demonstrators. They trade on this. They rely on it. They want it. They worship the chaos. And the chaos, of course, like the hyperinflation that breeds it, the chaos expands exponentially as an economy and the wealth of a people disintegrate. Hitler knew that. He played it like a fiddle. And Lenin knew that. Quote, this is Lenin, "There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of a society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the site of destruction. And it does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. By combining a popular hatred of the class of entrepreneurs with the blow already given to Social Security by the violent and arbitrary disturbance of contract, governments are fast rendering impossible a continuance of the social and economic order." Huh. Now, once again, to digress from our historical story for just a moment, what is the left promoting now? We saw Obama do his $10 trillion in debt and waste the money. We got no return out of the money at all. Zero. His $1 trillion stimulus, $800 billion stimulus. Oh, I guess the jobs weren't shovel ready. Remember that whole deal? Zero. In fact, a lot of that money was siphoned off in the typically corrupt fashion of his administration and paid to other left-wing groups to foment still more seditious, treasonous, dangerous, and anti-rule of law, anti-constitution, anti-family, anti-religion, anti-constitution groups. This was not an accident, folks. In Weimar Germany, it was not an accident either, but it was well-intentioned. The government didn't know what to do. They honestly thought they could kind of buy and grow their way out of it. The unintended consequence was, of course, the rise of totalitarianism in the form of Hitler's socialism. The modern left, and you can listen to the Democratic candidates, not only do they want to take wealth and redistribute it, they want to create endless deficits. Remember, their various programs, Elizabeth Warren's programs cost something like $56 trillion. Bernie Sanders would cost $63 trillion. Some of the other, even more left-wing, if that's possible, kooks, would cost $93 trillion. And how are they going to finance this? There isn't enough property and wealth in the United States, if you took it all from everybody, to finance it. So how are they going to do it? Well, what they can't get by taking from one and giving to the other, to buy votes, of course, they will simply print the money. That's MMT. I have talked about it on this show. Modern Monetary Theory. Type it in the search bar. Modern Monetary Theory says that deficits are okay. No problem. Print all the money you want. It's not a problem. As long as you keep printing the money, everything's going to just turn out roses. Well, I bring you back to our historical story for this morning. In fact, not only will it not turn out roses, it will, as history for 5,000 years, as Argentina, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, South Africa, before that, Rhodesia, on a slightly smaller scale, Greece and Crete, and bubbling to the surface now, Italy and Spain. As they have demonstrated, there is only one outcome to this path, unless corrected. And the left wants to print endless supplies of money, MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, to finance all this free stuff, cradle to grave, quote unquote, comforts. Of course, equal to the loss of individual freedom and the increase in government control. Wow. Do you kind of see how my historical story of this morning ties into potential scenarios elsewhere in the modern, quote-unquote, modern world? Rather fascinating. And every central bank, folks, in the West, every central bank, from the Federal Reserve to the European Union, you name it. Every central bank right now is engaged in a process of printing money, of attempted monetary policy stimulation. This is not something that tends to end well if one researches and follows history. But of course, that's another thing the left does. They obscure history. They twist it. They distort it, they manipulate it, and they erase it. Remember, The touchstone of the past is the guidepost to the future, which is exactly why it's under attack. Now, one of the things, and that is kind of the, and I'm sorry this wasn't a cute story for you this morning. Most of them are cute and have kind of an interesting twist. This one is just kind of a mind-boggling, eye-popping, jaw-dropping set of statistics, facts, and economic history. But it's something that, should we say, is not being brought to your attention. Instead, we're chasing down, Stormy Daniels. You know, I mean, holy smokes. It's just friggin' unbelievable is what it is. Along those lines, the Germans, having experienced this massive disintegration of their society and the resulting horrors that it brought, i.e. Hitler and his minions, have been absolutely loath. I mean, austere. They are, of all the European countries, the least likely to spend. One of the reasons they don't contribute to NATO, amongst others. And the most frugal, the most budget conscious. Well, the European Central Bank, under our buddy Draghi, is printing money like crazy. I mean, they are printing euros like there is no tomorrow. They're keeping what's called ZERP, zero interest rate programs, where, and I've talked about this before too, I'm not making this up, where literally if you are a depositor, you pay the bank to maintain your deposits. If you are a debtor, i.e. your mortgage, the bank pays you to owe it money. That's ZERP. And that comes from, quite frankly, too much money being printed. Too much money in circulation. Because what there is least of is worth most, and what there is most of is worth least. It's gotten so bad over there, and nobody's reported this, that in the last number of years, three German members of the ECB's executive, and the ECB is the European Central Bank's executive board, most notably a guy by the name, and I probably mispronounce it here, Sabine Lauschlager, have resigned because they are so diametrically opposed to the course that the central bank is taking in printing money like the old Weimar Republic. And I might add, that as they have stepped down, kind of as more conservative members of the board of the ECB, they've been replaced by more liberal members, and the ECB has accelerated its money printing, its ZERP policies, its easy money policies. Yet the European economies, folks, have not, there ain't no robust economy. I mean, they are not doing well over there at all. And the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, the pig countries, the southern European countries, have continued to do poorly, refinancing their debts over and over and over and over again, getting deeper and deeper and deeper in the hole. China is doing the same thing. They are flooding their markets with currency. They are at least building industries, buildings, even though they may be empty, and all sorts of other stuff. But, they are also embarked on a fiscal stimulation, in part, ironically, brought on by the trade war going on right now. Because the tariffs have hurt them far more than the United States. You know, they export $500-700 billion worth of stuff to the United States. The United States exports $100-120 billion worth of stuff to them. In a trade war, particularly waged through tariffs, the guy who exports least is hurt least. The guy who exports most, China, is hurt the most. So there is this Weimar Republic, forgetting the lessons of the Weimar Republic, mentality like around the globe right now. Around the globe. And nobody's talking about it. Nobody's talking about it. No, we're talking about Stormy Daniels. And we're talking about, you know, whatever other nonsense, whatever the glittering object of the day is. And the glittering object of the day is this whole impeachment deal, which once again, I still believe, is a Democratic ploy. Although they are really good at concealing it, they are really good at masking it to get rid of Joe Biden, number one. And number two, by Joe Biden, knowing that that is what the ploy is, I mean, he's not totally a political dummy after 30 years, to try and distract from he and his son's corruption with Ukraine and with China. And overall, a Democratic attempt to distract from what's coming down the both barrels of the William Barr shotgun, which is a whole bunch of indictments, exposure of the deep state, exposure of the corruption, malfeasance, and treason within the FBI, the CIA, the State Department, and the Justice Department. I mean, you know, the best defense is always offense. And I think you're seeing that employed now. So as I've said before, yes, you know, sit back and watch this impeachment circus. The more the Democrats do this, the more they hold their meetings in secret. I mean, think about this. You're trying to impeach a president of the United States, elected, you know, by 70 million, 65 million, whatever it was, votes. Somewhere in that neighborhood. So you are hiding from the American public the process by which you are removing the person they voted for. This will not end well for the Democrats. You cannot have closed door meetings with selective leaks. You cannot have witnesses hostile to the administration write a statement, which, of course, is their version of events, meant to make them look good and the poor victim and whatever, write a statement that the Democrats then release and then withhold the 8-hour transcript where the witness is cross-examined and tested. I mean, not only is it fundamentally unconstitutional process, and I don't, you know, all this nonsense about, well, the majority can make the House rules. Nonsense. The majority can't make House rules in contravention of the basic tenets of the Constitution, which is the right to confront your accusers. That is basic. And although Trump, as we're going to talk about here, has lost a couple of preliminary battles at the district court level with Obama-appointed judges. Gee, what a surprise! I think in the end, he's going to prevail. And so will, by the way, the Constitution. I mean, if you want to impeach somebody, let's slap it on the table. Let's have all the hearings. You bet. You know, one of the reasons the Democrats are hiding the hearings, too, not only do they know the news will not be really good for what they really would like to get accomplished, but they still remember what happened with the Kavanaugh hearings, which were totally public. Now think about if Christy Blasey Ford, gag me, if Christy Blasey Ford had been allowed to testify in public and only her statement had been released, That's the equivalent of what's going on right now. It is outrageous. The whole thing is outrageous. But the procedural stranglehold that the Democrats have put on it for obviously political purposes is so outrageous as to be unfathomable. But then, of course, they are unfathomable. Now, lots of things have come to light in the last week. You know, these so-called whistleblowers who aren't whistleblowers. The deep state changing the rules to allow whistleblowers to report secondhand information. The rule changes coming just before the whistleblower came out. The whistleblower meeting with Shifty Schiff's staff before issuing his secret and anonymous letter. The sudden rules by the House and the new rules by the deep state right before the whistleblower released his stuff to protect the identity of whistleblowers, i.e. this whistleblower. The suddenly advent of a second whistleblower. Jesus, this sounds like Kavanaugh, Christy Blasey Ford, and then all the babes that came after him, all the lying babes that came after her. Oh, he did this, and he did that, and he spiked the punch, and he was in this long line of boys that gang raped girls every weekend. And where did those stories go? To the dust heap of trashy lies where they belong. This is this is a repeat, but in secret. A repeat, but in secret. And we find out that the whistleblower, who is not a whistleblower, he's a leaker, a traitorous leaker. The whistleblower, he worked with Joe Biden before this. Really? Huh. What a coincidence. Right. And then the second whistleblower, somehow he has Democratic National Committee ties. Oh, well, gee, I'm so surprised. Anyway, sit back and watch the circus. In addition to the Democrats, I believe, digging a huge political or a deeper, because they're already in a political hole, a deeper political hole for themselves. You're going to see a backlash here. But you're going to see a backlash not only by the general public and the voting public against the press, which began several years ago, and against the Democrats, which has been building now for about a year as they talk about reparations and redistribution and eradicating Medicare and opening the borders and amnesty for 22 million illegal aliens, giving them the right to... I can go down the list. I'm not going to do that right now. It's not what this show is about. Well, plenty of time between now and the election to do that. But you will see a backlash on the part of Donald Trump. I don't know how many of you watched his two rallies, particularly the one in Minneapolis, although the one in Louisiana was not far off the mark. And something changed in his delivery from his last rallies. He's still the jovial warrior, the irreverent bell ringer, the focused, quote-unquote, home wrecker. In this case, home being Washington, D.C. But there was a note of anger in his delivery. There was a sharpness in his words. There was a directness in his attack on Biden, the Democrats, the process, the deep state, that has not been there in former rallies. I tell you often, don't listen when people are talking. Rather than focus on their words, watch their body language, watch their faces, watch their expressions. And then alternatively, or in conjunction, turn off watching them. In fact, turn away from the TV and just listen to them. Donald Trump is one pissed off human being. Never mind the fact he's the most powerful man in the world. He is pissed. After going through the Russia hoax for 2 years, in which I really think some folks are going to hang, which is one of the reasons you're seeing all this nonsense, all this distraction out there. He now is facing the Ukraine hoax. And just as in the Russia hoax, Hillary was the real perpetrator of Russian collusion with the fake dossier and Christopher Steele and all that stuff that we've discussed and that you know. So here, too, is Hillary, amazing, here she is again, Miss Corruption herself, and Joe Biden. They are accusing Trump of doing exactly what they did. It's exactly what they did in the Russia hoax. It is like out of a playbook. In fact, it is out of a playbook. And I think Donald Trump, who, I will tell you, because I understand the mentality, is a very dangerous man because he is super smart. He's a super planner. He is afraid of nothing. He likes the fight, and he will always get even with you. They are playing a really dangerous game. But we shall see. In the meantime, grab your popcorn and watch the show. Let's go back to economics. And this has to do with something that is near and dear to virtually everybody who's listening to this show, perhaps 100% of you. Even those of you who don't own a home, I'm sure 99% of those listeners would like to own a home or plan to own a home at some point. Well, there's some disturbing things going on in the mortgage markets. Nobody is talking about them. Zero. And I'm going to bring them to your attention this morning. And those are United States home mortgage modifications and what's called redefaults. That's when a mortgage goes into default. It's modified. Some type of workout is done. And then, subsequently, it redefaults. And, of course, putting the house at risk, the lender at risk, the United States Treasury, which backs the lender, at risk, with the laws that Obama passed, I've told you about these, the depositors at risk, because in 2010, Obama passed a law. He got a law passed by the Democratic Congress that said, without notice, the United States, when taking over a bank, can convert your deposit to capital stock of the bank, which, of course, saves the FDIC insurance money. Gee, isn't that great? And guess who holds the greatest amounts of mortgage workouts or modified mortgages, including in derivatives, which we've talked about, that are in default? Oh, that's right. The two big to fail banks, the SIFIs, those banks I've told you time and time and time again, get your money out of them. Chase Manhattan, JP Morgan, Citibank, all those giants, the 17 of them. If you have a dime in the Wells Fargo, which is a crooked bank to begin with, if you have a dime in those banks, folks, I'm going to suggest one last time. Move it to your local community. Check the balance sheets. Talk to your loan officers down there. You know, choose a bank that you're comfortable with, that's convenient for you, that has a good balance sheet, a good debt-to-asset ratio. And first of all, support Main Street. And secondly, get away from those too big to fail banks. You are just cruising for a bruising. It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be next year, but you're cruising for a bruising. Now think about the historical story I gave you. Think about it. This all ties in. Everything is interrelated. The politics, the aims of the left, the willingness, in fact, the eagerness of the left to distort, change, and unsettle society through monetary policy. Think about what Lenin said. Think about Hitler's rise to power. Think about what the modern democratic socialists, communists masquerading as socialists, think about their policies. Think about the cost. Think about where the money's going to come from. Well, it's going to come from a printing press and from your wallet and from your property. In the mortgage business, a mortgage modification basically, it can take a number of forms. But bottom line is, it takes three basic forms. You stretch out the amortization period, in other words, the amount of years that the borrower has to repay. You reduce the interest rate, and you add the delinquent interest in arrears, the stuff that went into default, to the outstanding principal balance, so the homeowner doesn't have to pay it except over time. Or you do and by the way, that's called capitalization. You capitalize the interest and you pay over time. All right. And then, of course, there's also the reducing the amount of principal owed, something banks don't much like to do because they have to take the hit on their balance sheet. These are staggering numbers. There was 8.7 million permanent modifications and 17 million temporary modifications was rolled out. They were called other workout plans, by the way. Were rolled out between 2000, roughly 10, the height of the downturn, when houses everywhere were underwater and people didn't have jobs and, you know, it was a mess, to now. 27 million, or actually 26 million, temporary and permanent mortgage modifications in the United States. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC, regulates all the national banks. And they issue reports. Gee, but nobody ever talks about them. And they're kind of hidden and buried. What a surprise. In its report for the first quarter of 2013, the OCC said that 47.3% of the modified mortgages had defaulted again. 47.3% of them were still current. The rest of them had defaulted and were classified as seriously delinquent. The most recent report by the OCC in the first quarter of 2019, 6 years later, noted that 21% of the most recently modified loans, that is, millions of loans that have been modified or temporarily modified since 2016. This is, you know, folks, we're 10 years past the downturn. 21% had already re-defaulted. The Federal Housing Administration, FHA. And they get their, I don't want to get obtuse here in the weeds. The FHA gets their money from all sorts of different pools, including a thing called Ginnie Mae. A 2014 report found that 57% of their modified loans had redefaulted. That is, redefaulted since they were modified. In July 2016, Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, you know, all those agencies that kind of collect and pool money for mortgages, etc. If you remember, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae went under in the last deal. They're now quasi-owned by the government, i.e. your tax money. Your tax money, by the way, bought them. Your tax money bailed them out. And your tax money now runs them, including their losses, folks. So all these loans that were remodified or temporarily modified that are now back in default, guess who's paying the losses? That's right. You and me, Bubba and Bobby Sue, we're paying it. There's a report called the Fitch Report. And it points out that there's a rising percentage of modifications between 2010 and 2015 and then ongoing to now, which were second or third modifications. In other words, there was a modification, there was a redefault, the bank or FHA or whoever the mortgage holder was, then remodified the loans, and then in many cases remodified the loans a third time. And there was still a huge number of redefaults. Huge number of redefaults. Three or more modifications were over 30% redefault rate. Two modifications were over 40% redefault rate. A single modification was at 50% redefault rate. I mean, think about it. Those are really high percentages. And we're talking about a total, remember, of 25 to 26 million loans. So when you say there's a 50% default rate, hell, if you say there's a 20%, you're talking about millions and millions of families and homeowners and homes. That's a lot of homes. Here's what I want you homeowners to think about, and you would-be homeowners to think about. Just as in the case in our little stories and the other economic stuff I'm focusing on tonight rather than the glittering object at hand, i.e. impeachment and whatever, whatever, whatever. Russia, 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 Ukraine, 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 China, China, China. This is like real life stuff to you and to me. This is everyday real stuff. This matters to us and our families and our wallets and our retirement and all sorts of other things. What do you think would happen to the housing markets in the United States, with almost no exception, if 5 to 8 million homes within a period of a year or two were suddenly dumped back on the market at fire sale prices by panicked banks who were otherwise going to be shut down by federal regulators if they didn't get rid of these bad assets? Do you think housing prices would go up? Or do you think they would go down? Do you think it would be kind of like the Weimar Republic? The more marks you have, the less each mark is worth, i.e. the more homes on the market, the less each home on the market is worth? Or do you think it would be the opposite? I mean, the answer is easy. The answer is really easy. And as for our friends, the big SIFI banks, the too big to fail, corrupt monster banks, who, as I've told you in previous shows about globalism, are mainly controlled by the 300 puppeteers, the elite of the elite that kind of run the planet, the globalist cabal, including George Soros, many of them left-leaning, many of them understanding what I explained to you at the beginning of the show, what the historical story I gave you of the Weimar Republic absolutely cements in history. It's a very dangerous combination. So, the big banks that you don't want to have your money in. J.P. Morgan Chase. They hold the second largest residential mortgage portfolio in the nation, including $10 billion of modified loans, which they call, by the way, troubled debt restructurings. 43% of that $10 billion in loans, folks, was listed as having redefaulted. Let's pick another one. Bank of America. Oh, yeah, they're a gem. 41% in their reports, 41% of their modified loans, also billions of dollars, had redefaulted. Wow. I could go on here, but it gets like more and more and more obtuse. But I think you get an example. I'm going to give you, to kind of put this in, like I used the bread in our historical story to bring home the point of massive hyperinflation and its cause and its effect and its result, its dangerous result. Let me take a tip. This is a true story now. Let me take a California mortgage. This was a mortgage that was taken out in 2008. The homeowner went into default. It was modified in 2015. The original loan in 2008 was $400,000. The borrower had been delinquent for several years at the time the modification was finally done in 2015. The interest that they had not paid, the arrears interest, combined with all the other expenses that the lender and the lender's attorney and everybody else piggybacked on there, totaled $127,766. In the modification 2015, that $127,766 was tacked on to the original $400,000 mortgage, which basically made a new mortgage, or a modified mortgage, or a restructured mortgage, however you want to look at it, of $515,000. The term of the new loan was stretched out from 30 to 40 years. The new monthly payment was $2,879, slightly less, like $100, less than the original payment. The original loan that was taken out in 2008 or because the original loan was taken out in 2008, after the modification, this borrower would be paying the mortgage for 47 years until it finally paid off, i.e. matured, in 2055. Now, this 2008 mortgage was taken out slightly after California home prices peaked in 2008. The value of the house, of course, as we all know, dropped substantially and bottomed in 2012. In 2015, the property was still underwater, although not by as much. But the borrower owed $115,000 more for the equivalent of a 17-year longer mortgage, right? 2008 to 2055. I want you to just ask yourself, what are the chances of that loan being paid off? Think about it. Now multiply that by millions of other homes in other places in similar circumstances. So redefault rates are kind of important to watch because they are, you know, I did a show called The Canaries in the Economic Mine. If you didn't listen to that, I did it roughly a year ago. You might want to listen to that show. But I would add to the canaries to be watched, this redefault rate, because it is going to be an underpinning of real estate, particularly residential values. And residential values, as we all know, comprise, for many of you listeners, the bulk of your net worth, the biggest nest egg you have, and never mind all the psychological comfort, security, roof, the whole nine yards. I mean, your house is a really big deal in your life. So I wanted to bring this to your attention. I'm not trying to be a doomsday person whatsoever, by the way. But these are facts that nobody else is bringing to you, and you need to know them. Because the more information you have, the better the decisions you will make. I want to talk about these three court cases, which, once again, other than this mainstream media outlet or the other crowing about briefly, you know, the end of Trump, it's finally the end of Trump. You know, it's unbelievable. So there is, there was a lawsuit on Trump's business records. Okay, going back to this nonsense impeachment stuff being done for not impeachment for all the other reasons we discussed, a three-court panel of the D.C. Circuit Court, Appeals Court, hardly a friendly environment for Trump, ruled that Congress can see 8 years of Trump's business records that are held by his accounting firm, Mazars USA. And this was sought by the House Oversight Committee. And it was sought because Michael Cohen, gee, isn't that the guy in jail for lying, testified that Trump had exaggerated his wealth when applying for loans, which happens to be a crime. Okay. I am sure that Trump will appeal again, first to the full D.C. Circuit Court, and then if he loses, up to the Supreme Court. And I have a feeling that the Supreme Court will grant cert, because this is a pretty big case on the authority between branches. I mean, it's a pretty big constitutional case. Then there's a guy by the name of U.S. District Court Judge George Daniels, Southern District of New York. Oh, you mean an Obama appointee? Oh, my. He issued, never mind the fact that there's been a bunch of cases that say exactly the opposite. Never mind that Supreme Court ruled that basically Trump can do what he's doing, taking money from the military and reappropriating it for the wall. Nonetheless, this U.S. District Court, completely ignoring the law, which is specific, completely ignoring the Constitution, which is specific, completely ignoring all the other court decisions and the Supreme Court, which are pretty specific, he writes a scathing opinion. Scathing opinion. And an injunction that blocks Trump's executive order, which would have taken effect next week, that would have made it easier to deny green cards and visas to immigrants who cannot demonstrate that they will not require public assistance. Public assistance, folks, is my wallet and your wallet. There was a dozen states that filed suit to block it. I wonder what they were. Oh, the blue states, California and Oregon and Washington and Connecticut and Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New Jersey and New York. Oh, those states. What a surprise. All right. Anyway, he put on a nationwide injunction, which I think that's a whole nother tale. A United States District Court sitting in New York should be able to put flop an injunction on just its district, like the Southern District of New York. His reach should not go all the way to Hawaii and to Texas. But that's a whole nother, that could be a whole nother show. Okay? There was another judge, another Obama appointee, Phyllis J. Hamilton. And she announced a similar injunction in a case that is run by California Attorney General Xavier Becerra. We've talked about him. I mean, a La Raza lefty. Anti-American La Raza lefty. Those decisions will be appealed. The president will win either at the appeals court or at the Supreme Court on those. Wall funding. Oh, here we have Judge David Briones, the Western District of Texas. Once again, this has been ruled on. The Supreme Court has looked at this. Nah, it doesn't matter. The Constitution grants the Article II powers to the president, and the Article II powers include the control of the borders, the control of immigration. The president can say, this guy can come in and this guy can't. That's the deal. And the Supreme Court has upheld the deal. And here comes another activist judge in the Western District of Texas, of all places, who rules that the declaration of a national emergency under which Trump is diverting funds from other agencies, i.e. the military, to construct a Mexico border wall was unlawful. And he finds, despite the clear wording of the laws and the Constitution and Article 2, he finds that the law expressly forbids, quote unquote, expressly forbids a president from using money allocated by Congress for any purpose other than was originally set forth. The lawsuit was brought by the county of El Paso. Remember, that's Beto O'Rourke's county, folks, and on the border. And the Border Network for Human Rights. Ooh, yes. Who, if we trace it back, is funded by George Soros's Open Society Foundation. Gee. Another one of those surprising coincidences. Anyway, the judge did not specify what should happen now, but asked for further briefings to decide if he should do an injunction or not. And of course, if he does, and he probably will, given his background and who he was appointed by, it'll be nationwide from the West Texas District. You can no longer build, you can't even build a wall between us and Canada, according to this judge. All right. So those are the three court cases which are not being talked about much, but that you need to know about and need to keep an eye on, because they're big cases. And should the president lose the case on his financial records, then I really doubt anything is wrong with his financial records. But I guarantee you the Democrats will create something wrong with his financial records and bubble along with this impeachment process, and, you know, we'll have more of the circus, and you'll be eating more popcorn, and we'll all grow fat as we watch in horror the deep state trying to disintegrate our country. Let's talk about international. I'm going to wrap the show up because I'm almost at my time limit. Oh, my. Number one. I have told you for months and months and months to keep your eye on the bouncing and dangerous ball of nuclear nastiness, which is Iran. And you know that Iran took out the half of the Saudi oil production facilities and was directly responsible and was likely directly involved, including through surrogates, in that destruction, which was total act of war. And you know all the other nastiness that Iran is doing everywhere using Obama's money, which increased our deficit, which means we had to print more money. It's quite interesting when you follow the circle in its full circular pattern. But the Saudis, obviously, are a little upset over losing half of their oil production capacity. So they threw two missiles at and hit an Iranian tanker yesterday. So the Mideast is kind of on fire. This is augmented by the fact that the president is pulling the troops. And by the way, I gave you a bad number last week. It's not 50 troops. In this entire sector, which is quite long along the Turkish border, there was 1,000 American troops, not 50. My mistake. I was looking at one portion of the sector, but the entire sector has 1,000 American special forces acting as advisors to the Kurds, who, of course, been our long-term allies, and very friendly with Israel. And the Kurd question is a big question. In my opinion, the Kurds deserve their own country. There are millions of them. They stand on their own two feet. They ask for very little help from anybody. They're willing to fight their own battles. They reach out helping hands to others in need. For instance, the Coptic Christians that were being assaulted by ISIS and were stranded on that mountain. To Israel in certain areas of cooperation. The Kurds are a good people. They're an Arabic people. They have that culture, but they are the closest thing we have to American spirit, other than Israel, in the Mideast that there is. And they have long stood shoulder to shoulder with the American military and against common foes, including Iran, including Assad, including, with great success, ISIS. And I don't disagree with Trump often on stuff, but I think his pulling out those troops is a horrendous error. And I'm not for foreign entanglements and foreign involvements and all this kind of stuff, but I am for preemptive military use. And for many, many reasons, the possible resurgence of ISIS, the Kurds having had to divert all their forces away from pursuing the last remnants of ISIS and guarding the 10,000 ISIS prisoners right now, to meeting an advancing Turkish army, which, by the way, has been, as of literally within days of Trump's announcement, began shelling and bombing with their air force, which the Kurds don't have. Kurdish positions all along the Turkish-Syrian boundary. And yesterday started to advance troops and armored columns into that boundary. With a result, I might add, that 100,000 new refugees have been created trying to get out of there. There's been hundreds of Kurdish Peshmerga soldiers killed. There's been a number of casualties unknown on the Turkish side. There's been a number of civilians killed. This is not good. This is not good. It is not a great message. I mean, who is going to partner with the United States? I mean, do you think that our partners in Afghanistan and our partners in Iraq and our partners in other places where we have covert or overt operations like Asia and Africa, Do you think that they're going to believe that the United States is going to take care of them? That they can trust the United States to continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with them when they risk their life and put their life on the line with nasty enemies? I mean, there's no nastier enemy than radical Islamists. Think about the French resistance in World War II. Now, many of those people had esprit de corps. They loved their country. They probably would have fought anyway. But do you think we would have gotten the cooperation we did if they had seen this type of situation transpiring with another nation? And the French resistance was key to the success of the Normandy invasion. I mean, they cut telegraph lines. They blew up railroad tracks so the Germans couldn't get in reinforcements. I mean, they did a bunch of stuff. I'm using it only as an analogy. First of all, I don't think it's morally right to leave a population of millions of people in distress, even though their men are brave and great fighters and fairly well equipped for ground combat. They don't have the amount of armor, tanks, etc., that the Turks do. They don't have an air force, which is, you know, modern day warfare. I mean, an air force is everything. And I'm just not with Trump on that decision. Not in the least. And I'm pretty sure that if you canvassed those 1,000 special forces that he's pulling out of there, that 99% of them would not be in agreement either. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. But to me, that is the most disappointing decision he's made in his presidency. And perhaps there's something else going on that we don't know about. I don't know. But Erdogan of Turkey is a nasty guy. He's a radical Islamist. Yes, Turkey's part of NATO, but I mean, hanging by a thread. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him. And I don't think Turkey would honor the NATO pact. If one country is attacked, Article 5 of the NATO treaty, if one country is attacked, all other countries will come to its aid. I don't think Erdogan would honor that one second. At the very least, Trump could have, and I hope he does, establish a no-fly zone enforced by American military power. So, you know, I mean, if you want to let the two armies duke it out on the ground, I have every belief that the Peshmerga will kick Turkish butt. But with the Turkish Air Force, it becomes a very one-sided battle with a lot of civilians, women and children and elderly at risk, and a whole nother refugee crisis in an area that is just, you know, decimated. There's 450,000 Kurds living within 3 kilometers of the Turkish-Syria border. So that'll give you an idea of how many people are at risk here. All right. So we have the Mideast, which is a roiling, boiling mess. Keep your eyes on that ball. And then we have China. Nothing's being said about the South China Sea. The United States is planning to send an aircraft carrier battle group to the South China Sea. There's been 3 occasions now where Chinese destroyers have almost rammed American destroyers in the South China Sea. This is a place where, and I've talked about on previous shows, China has taken underwater atolls and literally built them up so they're out of the water and then turned them into military islands complete with airstrips, land-to-ship missiles, you name it. Very tense place. By the way, augmented by the fact that it's tense in the trade negotiations, despite Trump saying that, you know, phase one negotiations were about done, et cetera, et cetera. You then have, and you haven't heard anything about it, Venezuela. This is a situation which is becoming horrible, moving to untenable. This is a pot that's going to boil in South America. This is a pot which contains the simmering waters of Russia, China, the United States. It has all the makings of a potential tempest, a boil over. Nobody's talking about it. Keep your eyes on Venezuela. And then Ukraine. You know. Ukraine, Russia. And of course, you always have Russia doing their nasty little things, hither, yither, and yon. Ukraine is interesting. The president that they've elected, you know, populism, nationalism is making a resurgence everywhere. In France, in Italy, in Spain, in Ukraine. Hungary has always had it. Here in the United States, i.e. the election of Donald Trump. Britain with Brexit, even though the globalists are still hoping to stave that off. And the reason, folks, is that current governments are doing such a lousy job of things. And economic disparity. Remember, all conflict, all wars, eventually and ultimately are created by or boiled down to economics. Except maybe in the case of Iran, where the conflict, the hatred, begins with religion, like a fanatic religious ideology, but has now been augmented by economics, because the sanctions are strangling them. Their economy is disintegrating. North Korea, the same thing. By the way, there's been renewed activity by Rocket Man over there. He's sent off several missiles. Nobody's talking about it, you know. There's a lot of hot spots, is what I'm getting at. There's four or five in particular you need to keep your eyes on, because they could degenerate in the twink of an eye into something much bigger. And that could degenerate in the twink of an eye to economic and other impacts here in the United States. So this show, I guess you could call kind of a hopefully interesting, hopefully informative, hopefully somewhat entertaining, if concerning, presentation of be alert, be wary, be nimble. Keep your eyes open. Keep the wind in your face. Next week, we're going to talk about voter fraud, which I've hoped to get to for the last 2 weeks. That is a segment that will open your eyes, and I'll tell you what you can do about it. And then we're going to talk about what Judicial Watch is doing. They are kicking butt. They're kicking butt on the Hillary front. They're kicking butt on the Russiagate front. They're kicking butt on this. Judicial Watch is terrific. You should give money to them. JudicialWatch.org. Send them $50. Send them $25. Send them $100. I mean, without these guys, none of this stuff would be going our way. We'd have no information. The deep state would be clammed up. You wouldn't know squat about all the nastiness that has occurred and is occurring. And they had a panel discussion, which I found fascinating, on investigating the investigators, what they're doing to get documents and records, which are then feeding to Congress and to the Justice Department. We're going to talk about that next week, too. And then we're going to talk about whatever craziness happens between now and then. And I'm sure there will be a bucket of it. In the meantime, have a great week. Enjoy. You know, thank you, producer. I did mean to say that. Why do I think the polls that say 51% of Americans want President Trump impeached and removed from office are totally bogus BS. Because I just got back from a book tour, folks. I left with 20,000 business cards. I came back with less than 2,200. That means in one way, shape, or form, over the course of about a 10-week tour, with just a few days and a week or so off here and there, I talked to or interacted with roughly 18,000 people. Think about that. 18,000. In some cases, it was merely a quick hello, here's a card. And in many cases, it was more than that. And in a number of cases, it was a few-minute discussion. And here's my takeaway. People are really pissed. They are pissed at Washington, D.C. They are pissed at the swamp. They are pissed at the deep state. They are upset with the Democrats. Maybe pissed, horrified, whatever you want to talk about. And they are rabidly and enthusiastically waiting to pull the voting lever. And they think, with the exception of perhaps 50% of the people I talked to in Wisconsin, which is always a 50-50 state, they think that the whole impeachment inquiry is a total bunch of political whack job nonsense. So after I talked, you know, that's what led me to believe Trump was going to be elected. I was one of the very few. Myself, Sean Hannity, a few others, thought Trump was going to be elected. In fact, we came to that conclusion when he came down the escalator. And I knew I was right after that summer's book tour, talking to, again, 16, 17,000 people. And that is why I know that the poll that was conducted is totally contrived. I don't know how it was contrived. Leading questions, improper ratio of Democrats or independents to Republicans or conservatives. What areas? I mean, was the sampling taken from Massachusetts? Or was the sampling taken from California? Or was the sampling heavily weighted toward the 10 blue states that brought the lawsuit I was just talking about? Or was it just made up? Not that the press would ever make anything up. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, so thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that. I did want to share that with you. Okay, and now I really am going to end this show. And I'm, 7 minutes over time. The radio stations will be upset. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll talk at you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.